Three mates, three headlines, what's next?
Episode 9, boys, and lots in store for today with a really exciting headline act and some terrific insight. But firstly, as always, how are you both doing? Any news to report from the North?
Good, thanks, mate. Quiet weekend, throwing darts at the board, getting ready to join the PDC tour. What about you, Sean? Busy?
No, weekend at work, but not much going on. So another quiet weekend in lockdown, watching Liverpool throw the title away so early, but never mind.
Lovely. City's to lose from here, by the way.
Well, before we get on with the episode, as always, a little reflection on the week's headlines to catch us up. European Cup rugby was cancelled due to travel concerns, and with the Premiership on hold, Sarries had no place to hide as they lost to Ealing Trailfinders in their first game post-relegation. Pochettino won his first trophy with PSG after only 11 days in the job, whilst in England, Brighton and West Brom both won, which forced Bruce to play four at the back, unsuccessfully. Maddison had to celebrate his goal socially distanced as players are banned from hugging, and Bruno became the first player to win four Player of the Month awards in a calendar year before putting in the worst display of the calendar year at Anfield. In America, James Harden left Houston for Brooklyn, dropped £40 on the flight across. LeBron channeled his inner Steph to throw a blind three, and there was a battle of the veterans in the NFL playoffs as Brady overcame Breeze, as young GOAT Mahomes led the Chiefs to the AFC title game despite turf toe. In Abu Dhabi, Max Holloway put in a career display to open Fight Island just 7 days out of McGregor-Poirier, whilst calling out the whole commentary team mid-fight and throwing no right hooks. And lastly, Australia have lost at the Gabba to the India's second team. At the Gabba, where they never lose, they've managed to lose. The crowd booed Tim Payne at the Gabba after they lost. India were bowled out for 36 earlier this series and still won the series because they beat Australia at the Gabba. Amazing. Any of those catch your eyes, boys? Have I missed anything?
Not sure if you missed anything. At the Gabba is a good one. I did see Ashwin tweet and also tag Tim Payne as well about the victory. And I also like the lap of honour they did with the flag after the victory. So I'm sure the Australian listeners will be turning off already.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I think you've covered all bases there. I thoroughly enjoyed watching. Was covered a bit on Monday Night Football while reflecting on the Liverpool-Man United game. Carragher and Neville and Dave Jones, the presenter, talk about the similarities to Man United's trip to Anfield to tackling a challenging par four course.
We are big fans of golf, Jimmy, so any link is enjoyed, let's say. Well, anyway, that covers that.
Doig, I think this week you're going first, so what's next?
Well, my headline for this week is from Sky Sports, and this is the Vitality Roses to face All Stars live on Sky Sports. Now, of course, the article is focusing on the England Roses girls who have been in camp this last week or so, preparing for their three-match series against the Barbarian-style opposition. And in order to get the very best insight into their preparations and what a journey to the wearing of the England Roses dress looks like, I was able to sit down with young star of the England Roses team and hear about life inside the camp as the squad prepare for the series and build towards a home Commonwealth Games in 2022. Former Super League Young Player of the Year, ex-Wasps and Mavericks shooting circle star, a massive thank you to this week's headline act, George Fisher, for speaking to the podcast. George, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate that you are in camp at the moment, so we really appreciate you joining us. How are you doing? How are things? Are you okay?
Yeah, no, I'm good. It's nice to actually be in camp, having some structure, playing some netball. So, yeah, no, it's nice to be in.
What's lockdown look like for you? Obviously, first time round netball was pulled completely almost. And now you're actually, even though it's bubbles, and it's all a little bit strange and manufactured. As you say, it's nice to be playing netball. But what's lockdown looked like for you throughout 2020, I guess, into now?
Well, at the beginning, I was in like complete denial. So I was like, there's no way we're not going to have a Super League season. No, no, they're not going to do that. And like, I was in denial, like, even when they told us, I was like, no, it's still going to happen. But it's just been, it's been crazy, to be fair. I think obviously Zoom's been a complete blessing, like, been able to like link in with the girls still, train on Zoom, like, a million one hit sessions. But no, it's to be fair, I think, although we haven't had netball, I've still felt really connected to the girls and kind of training really hard. And I've been able to do training that I've not necessarily done before that I've really enjoyed. So I've kind of like picked up running a bit, which I actually, I'm a goal shooter, so I don't run much, but actually I quite like it. So yeah, like it's been a pain, but then also like I still feel linked in and connected and stuff. So yeah. And then obviously like leading into this, it's just made us, I think it's made me feel, and I know some of the other girls just feel really like blessed to be able to play. So we never complain about a hard session because we're like, oh, at least we're together. At least we're throwing a ball to someone. So I think it's just made me like really appreciate actually how lucky we are to sort of play and be able to be together now, having not been able to.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the amount of Zoom quizzes and Zoom calls and bits and pieces that you've done, and then probably the one-to-one, and I know you can probably shoot when you're at home and locked down by yourself, or passing off a wall, and one-handed skills and tricks and bits and pieces that must get a bit repetitive. So being in a camp must be a nice change of scenery. But you are there in camp at the moment. It has just been announced that next week there's going to be a three-match series for the England Roses against an All-Stars team, which is going to be broadcast live on Sky Sports and their YouTube channel, which is not only fantastic exposure and coverage for netball, but it's also a really exciting challenge, I imagine. How are the preparations for that going in camp? A little different to the Jamaica team that you were expecting, I guess, but netball all the same.
Yeah, no, definitely. So we're kind of just prepping, well, for ourselves as such. So sometimes when you're heading into a series against another team, you're looking at how they play and sort of their style to combat that. And I think it's quite nice because playing the All-Stars team, you're not playing like a country or one in particular style. Within that team, you've got loads of different styles from loads of different places. So it's quite interesting because you're going to have to combat almost sort of like what an individual is doing, not necessarily a team. So it's made us really be able to gel together and kind of like figure out a bit more of our own style and how do we want to play and where do we want to go with it. So it's been quite nice to kind of think about ourselves in that aspect and bring right, what do we want, and then being able to play against a team that is so many different styles and so many different flares is also quite exciting. Like I've never played against, I don't think I've ever played like an all-star team as such, and it's going to be amazing to sort of see all the different styles all sort of merge into one. So yeah, it's been nice to kind of just focus on ourselves and stuff. But yeah,
I love it. That barbarian style feel, almost the rugby, and you see that when they go there. And I know they got into trouble in the middle of lockdown for going out and things. But that mixture, that coming together, that clash of styles, that blend of styles almost. Have you any idea who is even going to be in that All-Stars team at the moment? Have they given you a heads up even in that sense? Or is it you are preparing for absolutely anything potentially?
Well, I mean, we might have a little inkling. Who's in the team? So we might know.
By Wednesday, we'll all find out.
Yes, you'll all find out very soon.
No, very excited for that. You mentioned in camp and you mentioned through lockdown and bits and pieces that you were able to stay in touch with all the girls throughout the netball world. You do always seem such a close-knit community team whenever you're on international duty, whether it's away, whether that's at a tournament, whether that's at home just for a series or even the World Cup, etc. Especially nowadays when there's that blend of experience and youth amongst that team, what's the dynamic like at the moment when you've got to spend probably even more time with each other together in a camp in lockdown? And who are the jokers around the place? Who's constantly keeping morale high? Do you take that responsibility or is that left to someone else?
I think everyone, like, I think we're such an inclusive team and every single person is very unique. But actually, like, we all accept everyone's uniqueness, so you can just be whoever you want. So like I'm just I constantly fall over myself, fall over my feet, and I never feel embarrassed about it. We all just sort of laugh about it, shake it off, carry on. Like the physio's in the corner shaking her head. And then Serena's fantastic. She's just hilarious, always hyped up, keeping everyone going, always dropping the banter. But yeah, sort of like you've got obviously Serena who's older, I'm quite young, you've got sort of, we're like all different ages. I was talking to Beth earlier and we kind of just like match up from like young to old. But yeah, we all have our different personalities and I think that works quite nicely. And it's nice being able to be in a team. It doesn't matter if you're young, you're old, you're experienced, you're inexperienced. Everyone just takes you as who you are. So you can be completely yourself, feel completely comfortable. Like it doesn't matter if you're walking into a room full of coaches, teammates, old teammates, young teammates. You still approach it the exact same. And it's like a really sort of easygoing environment in the way that you could just communicate with anyone and everyone's really friendly, really accepting, which I think it is really good because being able to be yourself is like half the problem sometimes, isn't it? So, yeah.
I think it's amazing. I think that shows when you're on court together, there's the togetherness, and you celebrate each other's successes as well as winning and losing together, which happens in sport. And I think that does come across as being quite rightly recognised as being such a tight-knit and popular team. If we can go back from almost the present day in lockdown all the way back to the start and fly through the years with you, George, for a little bit of a snapshot of your playing career, what was your introduction to netball? Where did you play growing up? And when did you realise that you had a passion or a talent for the sport?
I don't know. I was a swimmer for many years, and I was like a proper like laddie, and I was like rugby, football, swimming. Yeah, like I was one of the boys, and I was like, "Mum, can I do rugby?" She was like, "No, there's no way of doing rugby." She's like, "You're too busy, you can't do it." And I was at a school tournament playing netball because I was forced to by my primary school teacher because my brother was the biggest in the school. He left, and she was like, "Right now, it's you. You're gonna have to do it." And I was 6 foot. I was probably like 11 years old, playing the school tournament. And the Kat Titmus, actually, she's a coach at Turnford, which is who I started playing for and who I've always played for, still play for him now, my big age of 22. And she went up to my mum and she was like, "Oh, can you bring her out to train?" And my mum was like, no. And like, I like walked in and interrupted the conversation. Obviously, manners, don't have any of them. Walked in and I was like, "Yeah, I'll come along." And my mum just like rolled her eyes. And it kind of started from there. So like when I was 11, kind of like started, I was just big. I was really, really tall. I was really Bambi-like. But no, I just went to the first session, couldn't catch, couldn't throw. I was so, so very bad, but I just liked the girls. And it was nice to be in like a team environment. So kind of from when I was 11, started playing. When I was 12, I got into regional academy and kind of started to like realise I was all right at netball. I was all right. I was like, "All right, I could do this. Let me train up. Let me see where we can go." And then when I was 13, it's quite funny. So Kat Titmus picked me up, and then Danny Titmus, her sister, was the coach at regional training. And she sent me for my first England trial at, I think, 12 or 13. And they were like, "She's too young. Like, bring her back next year," kind of. And then I was 14. So they selected me when I was 14. And I've kind of just been in the program ever since. So started under 17s, under 19s, under 21, seniors. I kind of like went typically up through the ranks, I guess. Got selected for the full-time Roses when I was 17, which was a shock. But no, just kind of rolled with it, just enjoyed it. I don't know.
Netball seems like I've got a slight inside view into the netball pathways, I guess, is the right way. The school I work at is one of the WASPs hubs, and I know that's part of that pathway program that gets them into it, and so there's a little bit of involvement in that. But the England pathways, the age groups and progression up towards the full England Roses camp, there does seem to be quite a clear cut progression system in place, a lot of success. But when you look back at an individual, there's not many people that just appear in the England Roses that haven't been recognised and groomed and coached the whole way through the system, which is a real testament to the system that you've obviously come through and been involved with.
Yeah, no, definitely. They change the system up every few years. So when I was going through the system, there was no such thing as a hub. And there wasn't such thing as like your young, so you're like under 15, like WASP say, or under 15 Mavericks say. So when I come up through the system, you would either play club level or then you played and it's NPL, but it was under 19. So it's kind of under 19 or seniors. And there was no sort of like flow into that. And it was kind of like, I think it was harder back then because you get to a point where you'd be like 15, 16. And it's like, am I ready to play under 19s? Like some of the best players in like the country of that age. So I think it's quite good kind of having the hubs and bringing it in. So like when you're younger, you can kind of have more stages instead of getting to a stage where like, well, I'm not ready to play that, and then stopping and or stunting as such. But kind of having the hubs is like a more fluid progression for people to like build up and then kind of be able to aim for them bigger things.
I think even from what I know, and again, maybe completely wrong, you can correct me, but in terms of how the Super League franchises, they work, they dip into the National League, the Premier League netball teams, and they pull one or two of the girls out, even from their age groups, and get training partners in, etc. I know we were just talking before about London Pulse using the Knights men's netball as their training partners, and I know other franchises around the place have used girls that are in the Premier League that they can pull in and be opposition effectively for their pre-season. And I just think in terms of, from an outsider's point of view, netball seemed to have the progression, the pathways, the involvement, the exposure and the experience that they give young girls making their way into the sport absolutely spot on compared to, say, football, where you just hear so many horror stories where people lose their way at 16 and that's them lost to the game almost. And I think netball does that really well.
I think it's hard because obviously I only really know the progression of netball because it's the sport I'm in. So when it comes to other sports, I can't really say because I don't really know anything about it. But I think it is quite good that I think we are quite an inclusive sport. Obviously, it's hard because we're a women's sport. And obviously, as you said, we're starting to get the men in, which is really, really nice. And like a few tournaments, like pre-season tournaments, we've had the Knights men's team come in and play. And it's actually really good to see because I've chatted to some of the guys and like it's just a complete different game. Like the women are like on the floor, change direction, change, and the men are all aerial, they're up and they're playing like that. And even in so when we was out in New Zealand, we watched the Cadbury's League, and then they had the New Zealand men play the New Zealand women, and it's fantastic to kind of see the men coming up and through and kind of coming into that as well, which is quite nice to watch because it's completely different netball to what we're all used to. But no, I think we're always trying to progress. We want as many people in the sport, and like we're doing well with the most female participated sport in the country, so I guess we're doing something right.
No, absolutely, 100%. And as I say, when in the school, it is growing in popularity and the participation numbers are there. I think also from a male point of view, I know in primary schools there is involvement in those mixed teams and the amount of parents that you say, my son really enjoys it, but at under 12, say, for example, that's them, that stops, what can we do? And I know there's a couple of guys involved with Knights and England's mixed netball doing an awful lot of work to try and include people throughout the age groups for young boys, obviously young girls, and to keep them involved throughout to get them to the level, whether that's with Knights or whether that's England men's netball, whether that's Nets for the mixed or whatever it might be, to keep everyone involved. And I think netball do it absolutely superbly. And I think you're absolutely quite right in what you're saying. You went through those Super League pathways. You, as you say, you were a youngster when you made that England Roses debut at just 17. What was that like from almost playing relatively little Super League professional netball to then be all of a sudden in the international scene quite quickly through your development?
I don't know. I think it's kind of like when you're in the environment and you're training and you're playing week in, week out, and you're with these girls and you're in camp, and it's kind of like, that's not what you're thinking when you go into it. You're like, right, this could be my first cap, and it's really exciting, but it's kind of task in hand. It's sort of like, I might not play because you don't know if you're going to play before the game or not. And it's kind of like, right, if you get the chance, you get the chance. If not, you don't drop a ball in the warm-up. Do you know what I mean? But no, it's kind of like, you know what your task is. You know what the game plan is. And it's kind of like, you get the task done, you go on, you do your job, and then it's afterwards, you're like, that's just happened. And it's something you can hold on together like forever. Like if you get one cap or you've got your Jay Clark and you've got 160 something caps, like they're all just as important as each other. And it's kind of like once you get that first and it's like, bagged it, I've got a cap for England. So it's amazing. It's kind of the feeling you feel after rather than in the moment, I guess, because you know what you're doing.
It's funny, a couple of weeks ago we spoke to Keaton Jennings, who's an England international cricketer, and he was saying exactly the same. Almost, you just prepare, you go and you play. And actually the moment he really enjoys, whether it's his own success, the team's success, is actually after, where you can take yourself away, whether that's in the change room with a beer or in the hotel after or whatever it might be. And actually it's the time where you're celebrating with one another is the real value in the cap or in the win or in whatever it may well be. And I think that's almost that same sentiment a little bit.
Definitely.
In terms of your playing, you mentioned Jade Clark there, and I know when you were in Wasps, when you played for Wasps, there was Tamsin Green where he was there, Rachel Dunn was there, and there's these figures that are so recognisable within netball. What were they like for you to play with? What were they like as mentors almost for you, and how much did you learn from them?
I have to say, I learned loads. I learned loads from them. You can't go into a team like that and not learn from them. Do you know what I mean? I think in the early stages of Wasps was a huge wake-up call for me, something that I needed. I think I turned up and I was like surrounded by all these amazing players, and I was still sort of a kid. And I remember sitting down with Tamsin for a session, and she was kind of like, George, like, what are you doing? And I was like, yeah, what am I doing? Like, I need to pull my finger out, I need to train harder, I need to just, I don't know. It was kind of like, a real wake-up call. And I think what Tamsin did really well for me is she coaches how I learn. So I'm severely dyslexic and I really struggle with like information being told to me. But what T did really well was she'd be like, do something, and she'd be like, stop. And she'd be like, why have you done that? And I'd have to be like, why have I done that? Yeah. And stuff like that. So I think that was really, really beneficial. But also like learning loads off Rachel Dunn. I feel like some parts of my game are quite similar to hers. And a few defenders have been like, you hold exactly like her, or you take ball the way she does. And I think, yeah, that was 2 years of watching her like week in, week out, day to day. And that was amazing. And obviously having Jade, who's just... she's just lovely. She's just such a lovely girl. Like, conversation I'm having with Jade and Nat, sort of like the feeders, try this training, putting me on like really far extended balls or short balls. And it was like all of us kind of working out where each other's ranges were and having them really good chats. I think being there made me grow up, and being around such amazing players, it also helps you learn. So I think it was a good time in my life to be there, and it was a really good environment to be in for me to like maximize my learning.
That's amazing. What about when you went and you joined Mavs, having been Young Player of the Year in the Super League, and you had a record behind you and you had playing caps, etc.? Was there a change in dynamic? Was there an expectation when you went there? Did you feel that, or was it very similar? Actually, I was going to do a job, I was going to be friends with the girls, I was going to just be involved. It's just a different dress almost.
I think it's different because Mavs, for me, I was the first Super League I ever played for. I started training with them when I was like 13, 14. And my first ever senior Super League cap was for Mavs when I was 16. So I hold Mavs obviously quite close to my heart because somewhere it's kind of the first proper netball I started playing. So when I came back, it was kind of like, I'm not that little kid again. I'm coming back as a netball player. And I think it actually took me a little while to realise I wasn't coming back to be a kid. I was coming back to actually be a player and be on that starting seven and be on that court and actually help lead and help have them conversations. I think it took me a little while coming from Wasps and kind of being almost nurtured a bit at Wasps because I was surrounded by so many of like these big great names. Not saying that the girls at Mavs aren't, because they're phenomenal players. You've got your Sasha Corbin, you've got Kadeem, we had Karen Bailey, Georgia Lees, like Gabby Marshall. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's kind of like coming back and realising I'm not the kid. Yeah, I'm still here to learn, but I need to step up now and actually become a Super League player. And I think Mavs was the first year I actually learned how to be a Super League player. And then I think not having a season was hard, because I think we was going to do really well. I just had a gut feeling we was going to do well. And they were like, no, COVID, not having a season. But yeah.
How hard was it for you then, following that abandonment of the season, no season involved in with COVID, to then move or agree and sign to go and play over in New Zealand, which you're going to be doing later on this year? I think in April or so you're going to be able to fly out to there, rather than almost have one more go with Mavs in that year, that team that was so exciting and had so much potential. Was that a difficult decision, or was it something that actually you just had to make for your career and your own playing?
To be honest, it was probably one of the hardest decisions I've had to make, because as I said, I just felt it's frustrating, because it would have been amazing. But I think for me personally, I just finished university. I've never lived outside of Hertfordshire in my life, and I was like, I want something different. I want something new. And that's like not on any of the teams in England. That was just kind of like a personal thing. And I was chatting to my manager, Michelle, from Step Out 7, and we were kind of chatting it out and stuff. And she was like, well, why don't you see what's happening abroad? And then kind of like Southern still happened. And I was like, oh my gosh. And like, I had a chat with the coaches and they were lovely. And I thought, why not? And I think that's, it feels, it almost, I remember having a conversation with my mum and I was like, it feels really selfish to want to go. It almost felt selfish because I knew what we could have done. So it's kind of like I had a real battle with myself. It's like, do I stay or do I go? And I thought, for me personally, it's the best thing I can do for myself right now. But then it was like that battle, like I feel like I'm letting them down. So I mean, my decision clearly shows you that I took almost a selfish decision in leaving. But I'm totally stoked about it. I am. I'm really excited. And it's been a dream of mine. Like, as a little kid, I always wanted to be like Joe Harton. Joe Harton played in New Zealand. I just always been a dream to play out there. So I was like, I'm going to do it.
It's incredibly exciting. And obviously the possibility out there, they're in a slightly better position than we are over here. There's crowds and things like that that could be... I know they get big numbers in there. I watched it, I remember when it returned back end of last year, and they were televising a lot of the netball league out from New Zealand. There's crowds and there's people, and they engage in it so much. They embrace it. They love their sport. And obviously the New Zealand national team are doing so well at the moment. And that'll be something that I'm sure you'll be able to bring a lot of expertise back. And even if it's inside knowledge on one or two of the players, as and when the Roses come up against the New Zealand in many of their series, or whether that's a World Cup or a Commonwealth Games, other than obviously going out to New Zealand being incredibly successful, what other goals have you got? What do you want to achieve? You say you wanted to go and play abroad, and now you're going to be able to go and do that. What else is there to achieve for George Fisher in netball?
There's loads of things to achieve. And to be fair, I think this probably sounds a bit weird, but I just want to learn. I just want to like really absorb and kind of like immerse myself. I've like never just been a netballer. So I've always been like studying, or I've been at school, uni. So I just want to immerse myself and learn as much as I can. And then I want to see where I can go with that. So I think my main thing is just to like learn loads, be a little sponge, absorb everything, and then see where I'm standing after that. Because I always like plan my life years and years ahead. And I think that's one thing the pandemic's taught me, is you don't know what's around the corner. So just take each day as it comes, and if you can learn as much as you can, then see where I'm standing, sort of thing. So that's kind of my goal. Learn and absorb, see where we're at the end.
I like that as a goal. And I was going to say, what goals are they, almost near and or long-term as well? But I think that answers that, so I won't ask that. George, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you talking to us, and we are so excited to follow the series next week against the All-Stars for the Roses. We're excited to see netball back on our screens, but equally excited, and we're wishing you all the best of luck to go out to New Zealand, and we'll be able to follow you with that out there. So thank you so much. Good luck, and we'll hopefully catch up with you soon at some
point.
Thank
you, and thanks for having me.
She is a superstar, eh? Not just an incredibly talented netballer, but an absolute star to speak to, and a wonderful advert for the Vitality England Roses, the Vitality Super League, and her future club from April over in New Zealand, the Southern Steel. So a massive thank you to George for her time. We look forward to seeing how George and all of the girls get on throughout this week against the All-Star opposition. Just a reminder, all three games are being televised live on Sky Sports and their YouTube channel. 6 p.m. on Wednesday and Friday, slightly later at 6:30 on Sunday evening. Can't wait to see them in action. Tinners, what's next?
Good to see a bit of Test cricket back, I think. So I've gone with Sky Sports headline, England's draw route batted out of this world, in perfect example of how to play spin, says Rob Key. So I just want to discuss what we thought happened over in Sri Lanka in the first test.
Well, Tinners, to be honest with you, as someone who famously got out 6 times in a row sweeping the ball, I'm not best placed to talk about spin or sweeping as Root did so effectively. So I am going to not tag team, I'll still be around, but I've brought in a favour. James Lunn, who is our cricket analyst, let's call him, is joining us. And he can help, he can offer his insight on my behalf. On talking that. So James, first of all, how are you doing? Did you watch the test match, and how good was that knock?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Hope you guys are too. I managed to catch some of the test match at the more sociable hours, but having watched the highlights, it was absolutely unbelievable knock from Root compared to the summer he had last year to come out in the first knock of 2021 and register a big double 100 like that. Was massive character, and it really set him off on hopefully what's a massive 2021 for him. The way he played spin was really, really good. Looking forward to the India series and the other test match in this series, it stands him in really good stead, and hopefully the rest of the team can kind of take a leaf out of his book and go from there with that.
There's a couple of them, obviously, that the main game, possibly, and I might be wrong in this, was won and lost in that first innings from both sides. I mean, Michael Vaughan described the Sri Lanka innings as the worst batting display in Test cricket, which I think is a little bit rich, considering India were 36 all out just a few weeks ago. But I do get the sentiment, and I think the comparison with how England then played, and certainly Joe Root and Dan Lawrence played on, obviously on his Test debut, the way they went about playing spin. What things did you pick up in terms of how they took on the Sri Lankan spinners, how they went about building their innings and obviously compiling two relatively big totals?
Yeah, I think the thing was, England and Sri Lanka almost looked like they were playing two different games in that first innings. And what was really key for me was that Root and Lawrence partnership, where they rotated the strike really well, but also used their feet to good effect. Looking at Root in particular, his sweeping was outstanding. I've seen quite a few pitch maps and images of the contact points of Root and Lawrence, and at no point in their innings did they get stuck on the crease, which is really, really important when you're playing against spin, because they manage to play the ball as far forward as they can before it has the opportunity to spin, or as far back as they can after it's spun, which then just effectively makes them a slow bowler. So that was really, really good, watching them use their feet to get forward and back. But like I mentioned, the sweeps, and not just the ability to sweep and sweep well, but the variety of sweeps they had in the game as well. There was one that stood out for me quite early on, was Dan Lawrence's slog sweep. I think he was on 27 or something at the time, and he got down, smashed the spinner for six over cow corner. It was a strong shot on debut and quite a brave one, but the execution technical wise of the sweeps was really good, especially for anyone else that's struggling to play spin and things like that. The head position was really, really important, whereas both players were able to get right down, their head right over their front knee, and be in full control of their sweep shots. As well as the variety of sweeps they played, Root demonstrated really well the ability to change between the hard sweep and more of a lap sweep, which gave him a great opportunity to manipulate the field more. Whereas when there was a fine leg in place, he could hard sweep and go in front of square. And then when that fine leg came squarer, he could paddle and go behind square. So it gave him a great opportunity, really, to kind of counteract what the Sri Lankan bowlers were trying to do and throw those counter punches so that he wasn't just letting the bowlers bowl to him.
Jimmy, your season last year didn't end in spectacular fashion. And James, you've just mentioned that obviously Root didn't have a brilliant 2020. So the way of starting 2021 with that double ton, now without embarrassing Jimmy too much, he's going into 2021 when the season returns on the back of two first ballers and is on for a 2-year hat trick, which would please everyone, really, to be brutally honest. But what advice have you got for Jimmy that Joe Root showed in terms of mental toughness and determination? And should Jimmy go out and slog sweep his first ball?
Definitely probably not slog sweep the first ball, but what I would say is
run at it.
Charge hard. What I would say is definitely treat that first ball as the most important thing in your life at that point. Go out and watch the ball as hard as you can, that first ball. After that, charge, slog sweep to your heart's content, but just make sure you don't get a hat-trick of first ballers.
I'm up for it. I'm absolutely up for a hat-trick of first ballers. But then again, so what? We go again the following week. What's the worst that's going to happen? It's a game of cricket. I've never really... The worst thing that I can do is think about it going into a situation. See ball, hit ball, no fielders in the car park. The one thing I took away from this test match is how much I would have to be paid to be told to go and field as a short leg when Joe Root's batting. He got a peppering. I don't know who it was, but that was a joy to watch. It was a moment after he'd been hit for something like the second time in about three overs. He was down on the ground and it was that look of, am I fuck doing that again?
I think he was half quite happy when he got hit on the head and the doctor had to take him off. I think he was like, right, well, at least I kind of just keep getting pinned, I'll go off now. But he was also on consecutive ducks as well, wasn't he? So he wasn't having the best game going either.
It's a bit like watching Joe Denley try and take on the short ball from the Aussies a couple of summers ago. Best way to play it's by letting it hit you.
One of the main things I saw in the test, sorry, was obviously we spoke, Doig spoke to Keaton Jennings a couple of episodes ago now, and obviously Dom Sibley's opening the batting for England at the moment on a spinning deck, and I know it's slightly different because the ball's brand new and it skids on slightly. Do we think that he's slightly out of his depth over there, and is he more of an English type batter who plays better in England and plays better possibly abroad in South Africa and Australia, let's say, and then when we do go to Sri Lanka and India, is it a possibility that Joe Burns will come straight back in and Sibley will miss out because he's not quite the player he is over in that kind of on those kind of pitches?
We'll do well to pick Joe Burns.
Joe Burns. You know, Rory Burns.
Yeah, one thing that stood out to me about Sibley was it's obviously he's got quite a idiosyncratic technique where he's not a traditional batsman, should we say. But one thing that stood out was his actual bat path. His dismissal in the first innings he was trying to turn a ball into the leg side that's only going to spin away from him. So that he's only playing with half a bat and he's going to get himself in a lot of trouble. Now, obviously, he played that shot in the first innings and then a bit of an iffy leave in the second. And it is a small sample size for him. But I think if he doesn't go well in the second test match, then he may well be under pressure. And Rory Burns would probably, for me, be the one to come back in at the top of the order, yeah.
But I think Burns comes back in because he's only away because his wife was giving birth. But the question is, who is opening alongside him? And Sibley looks so comfortable through the bubble in the summer and things like that. But as Tinners says, on the subcontinent, especially opening against spin, which is going to just happen and will continue to happen as soon as that weakness has been there. There's talk today about Bairstow potentially having that go because he's done okay. I don't think Zach Crawley's the answer at the top of the order, but it's who else could do that. But in terms of in the subcontinent, both Jimmy and Sean are fast bowlers, or at least certainly one of them is. One of them bowls up.
Oh, thanks, Andy.
In terms of being in the subcontinent, why is spin so important in terms of the wickets that they create, that they produce out there? Why is being able to play spin, play the ball late, play it under your eyes, and survive against a turning ball paramount to success out there?
I think because in Sri Lanka and India in particular, where obviously England are going to be this year, the pitch is so conducive to the spinning ball and their high-quality seamers are used to that. That's their home condition. So they're brought up, they're born and bred, putting the ball in a spot, having the ability to spin the ball and test the batsman. And I think that it's really, really important to nail the technical points of playing spin because there will be bad balls. And you have to, as a batsman out there, you have to give yourself the best opportunity to survive. And the more balls you face, the more balls you can endure, then the more chance you have of scoring runs and coming out the other side of it. And I also think out there, there's a really good opportunity to capitalise on seam bowling. Because as we saw in this in the last test match, the Sri Lankan seamers didn't bowl too many overs. So once England managed to manipulate the field against the spin, they had to then go back to the seamers, which presents another scoring opportunity altogether because the pitches don't facilitate seam bowling out there as much. So if you can endure and play well against spin, then you've got a great opportunity to build a long innings because you're going to be facing that for the majority of your knock.
Do you think, I know they both took a five for each and it's, I guess there's no such thing as a bad five for, just as there's no such thing as a bad 100 as a batter. But Don Bess's five from the first innings, there's this whole XG in football, which is now a massive stat. There's this whole sort of transfer into cricket where it's X wickets, for example, for number of expected wickets. His number of expected wickets from the balls that he bowled was 0.18 and he walked off with a five for. Now, that doesn't sound particularly threatening to me. And if I was Sri Lanka in that first innings, you'd be seriously questioning what was going wrong. But if you were India on the high that they've just had from winning this series in Australia, winning at the Gabba this morning, they'll go back. They've just announced their squad's players. They'll be licking their lips to take on someone like Don Bess, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you've got there is two teams probably at different stages of their test match cricket, where Sri Lanka just came back from an under par tour in South Africa. Were a little bit devoid of confidence in their batting unit. So some of the shots in there were shots from out-of-form cricketers. And you saw that, especially with, I think it's Dick Weller who gets a short one and chops it straight to point. And you think, yeah, Bess might have earned his luck there. Everyone needs a bit of luck to perform at high level. Whereas when you go to India, someone like a Rohit Sharma or a Virat Kohli or Pujara, absorbing those good balls, those half-trackers aren't going to be wicket balls. They're going to be the ones that get punished. You saw, seen India do it really well in Australia against their high-quality attack. So if there's a half-tracker or there's a full toss, it's going to go to the boundary. So I think, for me, their best just has to... Obviously, it's the first tour, first game in a while, but he's just got to get his rhythm. For me, sometimes he looks like he's trying a bit too hard and tries to bowl a little bit too quick, whereas Leach just looks to hit nice areas. So that's why I think he looks sometimes a little bit more threatening. But certainly they're going to have to tighten that spin bowling department up over in India if they're going to have success.
Jimmy, Bess or Moeen Ali to India? Who's going to play?
Bess will play.
Who would you rather play?
Couldn't give a toss, in all honesty. Ali's done in England, isn't he? Just looks devoid of confidence. A bit like everyone. terrified of the short ball shit against a spinner. Doesn't really want to step on a cricket pitch. That might just be me, but
I think Ali's done it in international cricket, but I also now think they can't make his last job on international cricket being a positive COVID test. So he's going to have one more game and swan song somewhere at least. But whether that's in India or not, I don't know. I'd like to see someone like Matt Parkinson have a go. He's obviously out there. There's the young lads from Surrey's across there, I think, as well. I know, Tinners, you've played against Parkinson a little bit, haven't you, in various levels, but what's he like? I know that was slightly different to playing test match cricket, but what's he like as a youngster? Has he got enough to make it or to have a go at least?
Well, he's certainly done me. I faced four balls off from three leg spinners that I missed, then I think I left his wrong, and so he absolutely had me. From what I remember playing against him, and he was unbelievable then. It was kind of him and Ben Whitehead at the time, and he's obviously gone to the next level. And I suppose from what you hear from people is that he's an excellent white ball cricketer, excellent with 2020s and stuff like that with lanks. But I think it's kind of that consistency that he might be lacking as of yet. But I suppose they won't know until they give him a go. And do you give him a go in Sri Lanka, or do you give him a go and chuck him in the deep end against India? I think for me, I didn't see the point of having the three seamers. I think they're probably missing a third spinner somewhere. And if Best can bat, and we know Best can bat and Leach, and you pick the right batting order, then I don't see why you need someone like Sam Curran. So I think they should give one of the young leg spinners a go. Mason Crane's had his go, then had a bad back. So I'd say you need to give him a go in this tour before you just throw him in at India and say good luck, son.
Bad of you to not mention the fact that I played against him, Andy.
Sorry, Jimmy, I didn't know your background, to be honest.
Well, I played against him, and to be honest, I played against him when his brother was a better bowler and bowled quite quick, and now he's a spinner as well, so shows how far the game's gone.
Well, to be fair, Tinners mentions Ben Whitehead there, and I think I faced him 9 times, and he has got me out 8, 6 of which were stumped because I didn't have a clue, so I just ran, so that sums up my playing spin. But I guess, obviously, as we mentioned before, and he compiled that run, he scored that double 100, and that is Joe Root, who picked up man of the match, and obviously as captain, as leader, and everyone was lauding him for that. He was on the phone to the lone fan on the fort at the end of the game and was speaking to him out in goal. Is he back on the basis of one innings, one good knock? Is he still in that conversation of top four batters in the world, the big four that people like to talk about, or is he not quite there yet on the back of one knock? Where does he rank in the rankings unofficially between ourselves?
I don't think he goes. I think one knock doesn't. There's not many of the players in that, those top four that you're saying have a year where they don't score Test 100. And I know last year they didn't play as much cricket as they probably would, but he's certainly in the. He's England's best player. Arguably Stokes is there as well, but he's certainly not. He doesn't get the numbers that Kane Williamson, Steve Smith, Kohli, arguably a couple of the Indian players as well, who don't get the mention because of Kohli. So I don't think he's in that top four, but he can certainly get back there, but he has to have a very good couple of years, I think. I don't even think it's one good year. I think it's two or three combined years.
I've got a lot of time for Root. He's the king of the start. Start and a toss-off, good enough for me.
Yeah, he's nice at a pretty 50 and then getting out. James, where does he fit for you amongst the best in the world, so to speak? Who's above him if he's not there himself?
Yeah, I think what Tinners has said there is really accurate, because if you look at someone like Labuschagne, who over the last couple of years has just produced runs for fun, then Root having a lean year and coming back, getting a big double 100 and then getting run out, tripping over his own bat, kind of doesn't really compare at the minute to where the likes of Labuschagne or Williamson are. So I think he's got all the potential to get back there, and another good couple of years of consistent runs will see him back up there with the likes of Kane Williamson, Babar Azam, Steve Smith, Virat Kohli, and I put Labuschagne in there as well. But yeah, I think definitely 2 or 3 years and be back up there.
I think it'd be interesting to see what happens, certainly considering in theory he's going to be going up against Kohli in India, and then at the end of the year he's going to be taking on Marnus and Steve Smith, and in the middle there, I think India are back across here at some point in the summer as well, so there's going to be lots of opportunity to see them against one another, and that will probably steal the headlines to some extent, but hopefully he can rise to that challenge, whereas in the past he's probably fell short a little bit, hasn't he?
Again, just a thanks to Lunny. It was really good to have him on. What did you think, Doig?
Yeah, really nice to get a slightly more analytical insight, a far more in-depth analysis than probably the three of us could have given on that and why England have won that first test. I'll tell you who else would have been a really good guest and someone to speak about international spin bowling if it wasn't for them blocking the podcast for no reason. That's Marlon Samuels, who wants nothing to do with us. He seems like a really good guy. But anyway, Jimmy, take us home. What's next?
I have got a tweet and a headline for us to look at this week, just joining into what I'm going to cover. So the tweet is from a gentleman called Paul Gibbons, and he tweeted saying he got handed a job he didn't deserve, jumped from the Championship to the Premier League, and now he's struggling despite spending an absolute fortune on a Bundesliga forward. But enough about Steve Bruce. How is Frank Lampard getting on? And then the article that I've picked up is from Karen Carney, and it talks about how Frank Lampard needs more time in the Chelsea job. Now, the actual point of my segment here is more about farcical comments that commentators and pundits have made along the lines, and the fact that nowadays you can get a job being classified as a journalist simply by kicking a ball in a previous career. It seems far too easy to accidentally fall upon a job like this nowadays, which just gets under the fan's skin. I don't know what you two think.
Yeah, there's a couple of things on there. To be honest, I didn't realise that Frank Lampard and Steve Bruce had quite so much in common, but they obviously clearly do. And they've probably both got fan bases that are on their backs at the moment, but we'll get into that in a second. But yeah, I fully agree. And I think across the board, I fully agree that media outlets and sport in general has to be far more inclusive. But I think it's very difficult for a fan base to get their head round an analytical point of view if someone makes consistent mistakes. And when you dig into their backgrounds, they aren't necessarily qualified to talk about what they are there to talk about, be that Premier League football and they've never played at that level, be that international cricket and they've never played international cricket, be that international rugby, they've never played international rugby. I understand that people have to be there and people have to talk about it for our benefit, but I think there is an accountability and there is an authenticity that also needs to be matched in the same capacity. There are more than enough qualified pundits that don't need to be making clickbait headlines when they're not qualified to do so.
That's all it is. It's clickbait at the end of the day. I mean, Darren Bent's come out today and said that Newcastle fans always go back to Rafa. The football's exactly the same. Rafa had a better CV, and that's why they didn't criticise the style. And obviously, Darren Bent played under Steve Bruce at Sunderland. Anyone who's played under Steve Bruce has got a positive thing to say about him because he's such a nice bloke. The football's dire to watch, and if you're watching it on a weekly basis, you'll notice it. I don't want to make this too much of a rant about Newcastle. I've got plenty of other terrible examples to add, predominantly from Michael Owen. But it's just, it seems that anyone can get a job now, pick up a pen or a keyboard, write any sort of article about any sporting theatre and get it printed anywhere. It just seems a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was going to say about pundits and ex-players is quite a lot of people who have played to the highest level. So I've got a couple here of an ex-England test captain and an ex-Australian wicketkeeper who made comments after India got bowled out. And I think the problem with quite a lot of those people is that quite arrogant because they've been to a certain level. So then they feel like they can say what they want. But actually, when a backfires on them, they don't enjoy it. They don't like the bit of the scrutiny that they get. I mean, Michael Vaughan said, "Told you, India are going to get hammered in this test series. Oz India 4-0 whitewash." And it's just one of those things where you think, why would you say that? What right? You played for England, but some time ago now, what gives him that given right to say that kind of thing? And I think that filters down onto the people who aren't quite as qualified as someone like Michael Vaughan to say those things. So is it not starts at the higher levels and then it builds, it kind of falls its way down?
Tell you what, Michael Vaughan is as guilty of anyone for clickbait headlines, mind, because he is the most guilty party going for pushing an agenda, certainly for players that he is affiliated with his promotional and management company. I mean, he has been pushing for players that can't even get into their county side to be playing for England on the back of one decent T20 knock. He makes calls about winning 4-0 and can't believe that they haven't won 4-0 out in in the Australia-India series. And because he makes a funny hashtag and he gives it an on at the end of it, people think, oh, fair enough, whatever. I think he's the worst of the lot, certainly within cricket. And I know he's far more qualified, but...
I wasn't even aware Michael Vaughan was still relevant. I knew he's part of the whole commentary team, but I couldn't have told you what comments he's doing, what agendas he's pushing, whose players he's backing, who he even commentates for nowadays. Just, how's he still getting a gig?
Well, he contradicted himself. I think the other day, I know...
Ashes 05 winner, carried by Flintoff and Peterson.
We've just talked about it with Lunny in terms of Joe Root's knock. On day one, he was saying that the Sri Lanka game was the worst advertisement for Test cricket. It's embarrassing. But then on day two, when Joe Root scores a double hundred, he's going, this is the prime example for Test cricket. On today, when Australia lose at the Gabba, he's saying, this is why Test cricket should be 5-day. Only 6 months ago, he's saying it should be 4-day Test matches to get more Test matches in and more people into the game. Whatever suits his agenda day to day. And it's almost as if these people are naive to the fact that someone will screenshot it and someone will bring it back up 12 months down the line and catch them out for it. And because, as I say, he makes an on hashtag, he laughs it off, and he probably laughs it off because he probably does get heckled quite a bit, but he makes a hell of a lot of gaffes.
I mean, one of the tweet I saw there with these five statements on, he had then, underneath it, he'd quoted another tweet of the Tim Payne thing that said, can't wait to get you out the Gabba. And it was just, and it said, things coming back to bite you in the arse. But actually, the tweet above was this comment about the 4-0. And you think, well, come on now. That is literally, like you say, day-to-day agenda. He just goes with whatever he thinks fits with what's going on.
Is he the Chris Sutton of the cricketing world? Chris Sutton is an absolute shithouse. And I've got a couple of his comments that I've screenshot.
Who's worse, Jimmy? And I might even take this to the Instagram poll. Who's worse, Chris Sutton and Robbie Savage, or Adrian Durham and Darren Goff for clickbait?
That's good. What you would say is at least Savage and Sutton have done it. Goff and Durham are just absolute knackers. Darren Goff. You talk about Michael Vaughan. Well, I talk about Michael Vaughan trying to stay relevant. Darren Goff's even worse. Since you're famous for one little daft little gag he pulled at Shane Watson up at Durham in 2005. And he's somehow landed a gig on one of the worst radio shows going. Sutton and Savage are a funny one. Savage is still a little bit on hooks because of what happened up at Rochdale about a year ago with the Newcastle fans, where he got absolutely humiliated on national radio. Chris Sutton's just a wind-up merchant with his comments along the lines of, I took screenshots of them, Celtic reserves are bigger than Leicester City. And quite frankly, it stinks. The timing of it stinks. He's going to a club that are playing for absolutely nothing, and I'm really disappointed. That was him on Brendan Rodgers joining Leicester. Leicester City, who were sat second in the Premier League table.
Yeah, and Celtic, who would absolutely beg for him back right now.
Well, the other thing that I was going to bring up, which I've not entirely seen the full thing of, but it's all over social media at the minute, is Neil Lennon's presser.
Yeah.
Absolutely dynamite.
Out in Dubai, or about Dubai.
He's lost the plot. He's up there with Brucey as people that are just, they're gone in the head. He's gone on all levels and he's turned on the press.
What else have you got for us, Jimmy?
I'd like to see that on the poll to see what people think. But
more tweets, more headlines for us, Jimmy. Guess the journo. What have you got?
Guess the journo. Let's see. Took some screenshots. Who came out with the comments of Peter Schmeichel will be like a father figure to Kasper Schmeichel?
That is Michael Owen-esque. So,
oh no, it's not. It's Jamie Redknapp.
Wow,
up there though with one of the bigger helmets on television at the minute. A former Premier League club's owner came out with a nice one, which has backfired drastically. Get your coat, Ollie. That was from Simon Jordan.
Yeah, he's a good talk sport clickbaiter. He likes to get in there with Durham and Goff and just make headlines for the sake of it.
One that I think Sean will quite enjoy, and a name that we've literally just mentioned there. He slows it down. They've gone from heavy metal to lift music with Thiago. Terrific career, talented football player, but he's totally wrong for Liverpool. TalkSport journalist, you know, Adrian Durham.
Yeah, I just read that earlier. Yeah. And it's a very good clickbait because it makes it sound like Klopp's come out and said that.
It literally, it couldn't come from anyone else's mouth but Adrian Durham and Darren Goff.
Yeah, but the way it's written, it's the perfect clickbait because it says Klopp says, and it's like, well, obviously, why would he ever say
that? Well, I was watching last night on, obviously, the Newcastle game when they were playing Arsenal getting turned over. And after the game on Monday Night Football, they were talking Carragher and Neville. And they were getting their Twitter questions in. They were talking about the Liverpool front three and how potent they are or not and what's going wrong at Liverpool. And they were saying, Neville was saying they're just missing Jota. And actually, it's they're having to play that front three all the time. And the reason they're not firing is because they're absolutely knackered. And they bought Jota and they want to be able to rotate the other three and play Jota all the time. But obviously, they can't do that while he's on the sidelines. But they were almost then saying this morning, when you look at a headline, Liverpool's front three are finished. And I don't get, I understand it. It's a clickbait. You click on that, you go, goodness me, what did they say? Neville said they're finished. And you look at it, and actually what he's saying is they're not as effective at the moment because someone's injured that they're trying to do. And what they're trying, what Klopp's trying to do is they're trying to get it right. But the headline saying Liverpool's front three are finished, Klopp's getting it all wrong. And it, those words have never come out of his mouth or not even been hinted at. But because it'll get millions of clicks, that's what they go with. And I know that some people, as we're saying, your Suttons, your Savages, your Durhams, your Michael Owens, your Redknapps, Souness, when he goes after Pogba out of absolutely nowhere. People make mistakes. People say things that are just horrifically wrong, but also media outlets like to twist so that they can get their revenue. And I think sometimes people get caught out by that, but
how many times, though, do you think a commentator comes out with a statement, a bit like Souness with Pogba, where he thought, right, I've said it now, I'm going to have to stick with it. I don't necessarily agree with it. It's a bit, I'm too stubborn to turn around and admit when I've been wrong and hold my hands up. So I've got a lot of time for a journalist that will do that and just say, right, I made a comment about 3 years ago. I fucked it a little bit with it, but I'm going to stand by it and run with it.
You're going to have to roll.
But what about the initial tweet, though, Jimmy? Yeah. Who goes first? Who gets the sack first out of Lampard and Bruce?
Oh, Bruce. I can't see Lampard going. Or the point I was going to make is they've spent an absolute fortune to be up there with Liverpool City, and it's actually Man United who are now so-called challenging them for that title, and Chelsea just look well off the pace. They're being compared with Arsenal for that place in fourth. Leicester City sneak under the radar, and they're sort of tiptoeing through and getting themselves into another great position. Hopefully they can finish the season strong because I'd quite like to see them do well. It'll be Bruce that goes first. There's no doubt about that. It's just a case of when. Hopefully it's not too late like it was under McLaren.
Well, we raised the question earlier on, Jimmy, just obviously off air, after the incident at the Gabba. Who goes first then, Bruce or Tim Payne?
You'd probably say Tim Payne goes first for Australia. I could be horribly wrong here, but he's done nothing for me in Test cricket. And that was just he's been embarrassed by India and Ashwin.
Does he stand down or does he get kind of released of duties?
I think he's relieved. I think they do a press conference, they do a wash down. Whenever they've got to announce their next squad, they say Tim Payne won't be captaining and it's going to be Pat Cummins or Steve Smith. Why don't we just go back to being ruthless? When Australia were good, let's get Steve Smith back in. Let's get the sandpaper back out and let's win again.
Get the band back together. Davey Warner, what are you doing, son? I've got one more just before we decide to shoot off, though, which I think you'll enjoy because it's from everyone's favourite TV pundit, Tim Sherwood. And we've all heard it. It is another corner. I'm not too worried about this corner. It might come back to bite me, he said. I think Tottenham have the dominance in the air. I'm not sure anyone can get their head on the ball first. Roberto Firmino goal.
There's some brilliant ones on there. Soccer Saturday or the BT watch along and things like that where pundits make those exact statements. They say, oh, I'm not so worried. There was one I was listening to and it was Ward-Prowse was over a free kick and whoever it was, I can't remember who it might have been, was saying, oh, they'll not be too worried. They're only putting one man in the wall, two man in the wall. Like, he'll shoot here. He's not going to swing this one in. And that's 1-0 Southampton, as he puts it, top bins. And you just sort of think,
can you remember the Steve McLaren one in the 2016 Euros with Iceland?
Go on.
Talking about, I've not screenshotted this, so I can't run through what the article was without having to Google it and waste everyone's time for 5 minutes while I go through it. it was all about how England had just equalised against Iceland. They were coming back in the game, you know. He was talking about how England's midfield were taking control. Absolutely no concern about what Iceland have got. They've got the two players, Sigurdsson, and oh, he scored 2-1.
Well, one thing we are going to test our knowledge on, which may well come well to come back to bite us in the arse at the other end. We're going to make another prediction for this weekend. It is the Conor McGregor v Dustin Poirier 2. It is the rematch there over on Fight Island in Abu Dhabi on Saturday night. We're going to make our predictions. Who is going to win and what round or by points, whatever your prediction may well be. Tinners.
McGregor, third round.
Jimmy?
I'm going to go McGregor second round, which is based on two things. I know nothing about UFC and I don't even know who he's fighting, so I can't even put the Oppo's name into it.
I think it could be a good fight, Jimmy. I've listened to a lot of the hype of being sold on both fighters winning both by various different ways. I think McGregor, purely on the basis that he is so good at his own predictions and he has got them right so many times and they've come true, I'm going to back him. And what he has been saying all week is that he's going to win inside 60 seconds. So I'm going Conor McGregor to win by knockout in the first round. That is my prediction. So,
do you think your prediction this week will be better than your prediction last week? I feel like we've glossed over this. Ben Folks, how did he get on?
Yeah, Ben Folks was hard done to. But we also did say that whoever replaced my prediction, I would get their run. So technically, I won out of the three of us because I got Dan Lawrence, who got the pick.
Doggy, you could have all 10 other players apart from Root and you still wouldn't have won.
Yeah, that's true. But that's a great episode this week. It's been good fun. Thanks very much for your time, gentlemen. I look forward to catching up with you soon. Have you got anything else to say before we go?
Thoroughly enjoyed it, lads. I'll see you next week.
Yeah, just thanks to the two people that came on.
Yeah, good luck to the girls, and thanks very much to Lunny. We will see you soon.
See you, lads.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum, going around like bum, bum, bum.